Hello, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin.
It was raisins in the cookie, not chocolate. You watched the final episode of that TV show, so much potential, but they really blew it. The end was profoundly meh. You scan the ballot. Were these really the best that your country, your state, your party could do? Are there any heroes left? Heck, are there any decent functional people running for office anymore? You thought that this would be the place that you would belong. The place you would have friends, the place you could give yourself to and be given back to. And it's not terrible. You don't get your back stabbed like you have before, but it's almost worse. No one even tries to invest. Suddenly, you realize that this relationship, the one that you have invested years in, is just not going to work. This person will not be your wife, your husband. You'll just have to start over with someone else. And hope for the best. You had dreams, a picture of what life could be, of the ways that you could change the world. But after years and years of trying and door after door being closed, you just have to make money. Life doesn't look like you thought it would. You feel a twinge of something in your stomach. What is this? This is disappointment, a common human experience. Merriam-Webster defines disappointment as a noun, the sadness or pleasure caused by the non-fulfillment of one's hopes or expectations. And disappointment, I would suggest, is the state that many in my generation find themselves in. As the word millennial has entered the mainstream vocabulary and we've entered into the adult world of business and arts and politics, I've had an increasing number of people email me and ask, "What do you think defines millennials?" When I was a resident advisor at an undergraduate university, they gave me a lecture on the generational trends within millennials based on a great deal of research. They said that they're team players. They had more after-school activities than any previous generations. They were special. We were all raised to think that we had some special part to play in society, something unique that only we could give, that we could make a difference. Traditional. Believe it or not, millennials are kind of squares. They engage in less risky behaviors than previous generations, and many of them describe the desire to have something like a traditional life. They want to get married and have children. All of these aspects describe different things about millennials. But over the years, I've come to think that something else identifies us. We share something else, and perhaps something more fundamental in common. What is it to be a millennial? It's to be disappointed. Now, don't mistake me. Many characterize millennials as whiny, difficult, unresilient, and perhaps some of that is true. But you know what else is true? In their formative years, or perhaps I should say in our formative years, millennials saw two economic crashes. They saw two towers burn down. They saw one, and now two, Catholic abuse scandals. They saw countless evangelical pastors fall into disgrace, affairs, and abuse. They were born into a confusing war in the Middle East that never seemed to have really began and never seemed like it would actually end. They grew up in an era of unprecedented political polarization. They watched the sky grow cloudier with pollution. They grew up being told, we grew up being told, that if you worked hard and got good grades in college, that you would get a good job and be able to have a stable life. And now that we've graduated, we watch as the price of living soars higher and higher, and as the average income hovers steadily over the same line that it did in the 1980s. Maybe we are a little bit whiny, but maybe we have reasons to be. To put it as many 90s parents did in all the films we grew up watching, millennials aren't angry, they're just disappointed. But perhaps there is a little bit of anger in there as well. After all, with disappointment comes a sense of betrayal. Raisins? Not chocolate? How could you? What I see in a lot of millennials is a sense of betrayal, of being let down, of having been given a vision of life, being set up to live it, and then finding out that that vision was impossible. This is not how we were told it would be. This is not what we expected. It is hard and lonely and really, really expensive. Disappointment. But it's not just millennials. We all come to moments in our lives where life is not what we thought it would be, not what we expected, not even what we wanted. Moments where we find ourselves not exactly sad about our circumstances, just underwhelmed, annoyed almost, disappointed. We would rather have had it a different way. And you know what? Disappointment is not wrong. It is a very rational, normal response. The world is disappointing. Sometimes our lives are disappointing. We can't pretend it isn't so. But so much of our lives will be decided by how we handle disappointment. Do we ignore it, slowly numbing ourselves to any real desires? Do we sink into a perpetual state of griping, letting bitterness take over our personality and our life like a parasitic weed? Or do we grieve, wash our faces, stoop to pick up worn-out tools, praying for new energy and creativity to make something beautiful with the shards and pieces that God has given us? What do we do with a disappointing world? What do we do with disappointment? This is the question that today's podcast will address. We'll explore this question through the lens of three pieces of art, one musical, one visual, and one literary. First, we'll look at the song Change of Heart by the pop punk band The 1975, a song that deals with disappointment in the world and friends and in ourselves as the possibility for a turn towards something new. For our visual example, we'll look at The Ladies in Lavender, a story about two women who've lived in 50 years of disappointment after the world wars, but find themselves suddenly faced with a surprise. Will their disappointment shape the way they experience it, or will they open themselves to a new hope, a life they didn't expect, but that could be better than they'd expected? And then finally, we'll look at the literary example of Hannah Coulter by Wendell Berry, a book that follows the life of one woman whose life didn't turn out at all how she thought it would be, and how through her small faithfulness, seeds of hope are sown even in today's dark and difficult times. Though we may be disappointed, I don't want our disappointment to be the thing that defines us. I want my generation to be remembered as one who let their disappointment burn away the dross, that it pushed them towards fighting for things that really matter and for building their lives on something good. Before we dive into this week's examples, I want to remind you of a few things. The first is that Speaking with Joy is an Anselm Society-sponsored podcast. The Anselm Society is a group in the Rocky Mountain region seeking to find a renaissance in the Christian imagination by connecting churches and artists. Go check out their website at anselmsociety.org. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, share it with your friends on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and make sure to find me there as well. Also, if you rate this on iTunes, it helps other people find the podcast, so please do that if you enjoy today's episode. And finally, I have a Patreon, which is a way for you to get more out of the podcast and me to continue being able to make them. It's $10 a month, and as a thank you for supporting me, you'll get secret podcasts, a newsletter, just fun things like a Spotify playlist, and we have an artist every month, and I'll send you downloads of songs and images from local artists. You can connect with their work. The support of patrons has kept me doing this podcast, and it's also supported me as I do my doctoral research at the University of St. Andrews. It kind of keeps me accountable, and it makes me want to make great episodes. So, if you're interested in that, check out patreon.com/joyclarkson. I would love to see you over there. So without further ado, let's dive into this week's topic, disappointment. I feel as though I've been deceived. I never found love in the city. I just sat in self-pity and cried in the car. I've had a change of heart. Now, if that's not disappointment, then I don't know what is. Those are some of the most striking lines to me in this song, Change of Heart by the 1975. Now, it might come as a surprise to you if I said that, compared to the rest of their oeuvre, these are fairly unmelodramatic lyrics. This band, a collection of high school friends from Manchester, is famous for their melodrama, their emotion, their bigger-than-life shows, and their pretentious aesthetic. I love the 1975, but it's kind of an off-brand thing for me to love. They sing about girls and drugs and rock and roll, all things that you might be surprised to hear I'm not very involved with. Loving the 1975 for me is like when you find out that a really sweet person does kickboxing. But there's something compelling to me about their music. For one thing, their musicality is delightful and their production is amazing. But it's something deeper than that. I've thought a lot about the pieces that I share with you all, and sometimes I want to share music or art that doesn't necessarily encourage us or doesn't necessarily match with our worldview, but we enjoy it and we listen to it, we think about it because it helps us understand the world we live in, because it opens our eyes to the experience of others, and because it helps us understand something that we wouldn't understand if we hadn't listened to it. And that's the case with the 1975. Don't hear this as an all-out endorsement of their music. I picked them because there's something about them that I actually think we share. But before we dive into the song that we're going to talk about, let me tell you a little bit of the history of how I came upon this band and why I chose them for this week's segment. Now, I first heard about the 1975 in my senior year of college. I think it was my senior year. No, it was the second year. It was not my senior year. It was the year that I was an RA. And my dear friend Lainey, she's just like the person you want to have in your life for music recommendations, because she always somehow manages to find people that like just suit you. And she showed me one of their songs. It was called Chocolate. I honestly couldn't understand 90% of it because they have very strong Mancunian accents. That's the Manchester accent. And when I listened to it, literally the only word that I could discern from the song was the word chocolate. If you ever hear it, people always joke that it sounds like he just says, "Oh, chocolate," because he's got a very unique and wonderful accent. Anyway, so Lainey had shown me this song, and Lainey is kind of an evangelist for the bands that she likes. And so I was kind of neither here nor there about them, but she kept on playing with them for me and following me around. And she was kind of my friend too, when I was under a lot of stress, under a lot of work, would kind of pull me out, make me eat something bad for me, and make me listen to something fun or watch a movie. So this kept on coming up over and over again, and she started showing more of their music. And I started to be really kind of fascinated by them, kind of compelled by them. And I couldn't quite place why, because, I mean, they're very different from me. You know, I am this kind of straight-laced North American from the mountain towns. I've, you know, done all the normal things. I've gone to college. I've been fairly well behaved, you know. And this is this band that's singing about dropping out of high school and, you know, doing things they shouldn't and exploring religious questions, but they're very agnostic. And I thought, why is it that I connect with this? Because I didn't really connect with their conclusions that they drew. It didn't make me question my faith. It didn't make me question my lifestyle. But there was something that was really kind of compelling about them. And I think I only really realized what it was that I found compelling about them when they released their last album. So their first album is almost comically rebellious. It's all in black and white. Everything's very serious. If I were to choose words, I would say that it was pretentious, that it was ironic, sarcastic, agnostic. Not even just agnostic, it's definitely more atheistic. Like there's this sense of kind of anger against, you know, religion, the sense that they don't like how life is, so they're going to rebel and they're going to transcend the normal moral order of things. And that's all reflected in that it is very black and white. It's literally their album cover, their music videos were all black and white. And then the next album they did, and the album we're going to look a little bit at today, had suddenly changed. Their tone, their production had grown softer. They had a pale pink album cover. All of their music videos were in these kind of pale colors. There was a very distinct shift. Now, don't get me wrong, they were still shocking and still advocated doing things that I would not advocate doing. But there was a real sense, a real change in their tone. And one song that really revealed this to me was, there's a song called If I Believe You. And it's a song actually written to Jesus. And Matty Healy, who's the head man of the show, and he's very, he's been very explicitly against religion, although he's grown softer about that. And he said he went to a gospel choir and he was really moved by it. And he said, you know, I just wonder if I could have believed in God if I had been around all these gospel choirs. So he wrote this song to Jesus, and the the key line in the middle of it is, I'm asking you, Jesus, to show yourself. And that goes over and over again in the chorus. And of course, there's a little bit of irony and a little bit of sarcasm in it. You don't feel like he's entirely sincere, but you think that at some level he is. The song ends with, if I'm lost, how can I find myself? And he says this over and over and over again, ending this song to Jesus. And there's a sense that even though he is so frustrated by organized religion, even though he's rebellious and has all these issues and has all these questions, he's suddenly come to this place where he's no longer black and white. He no longer thinks that just rebelling is the thing that will lead him to answers. There's this real sense of longing for something to sink his teeth into, longing for something real. And I think that a big part of that softening of the heart that also comes out in their music, is actually a disappointment with the rebellion, if you want to call it that, of the first album. And that comes out in the ways that they actually quote the first album numerous times in the second album. And I'm going to show you that with this other song called Change of Heart. And Change of Heart to me is a song that is all about someone who has lived in a particular manner and has found it really disappointing, has found it not to answer the desires of their heart that they were trying to satisfy. And we're going to go through and look at all the places where he references the past album and the ways that he uses that to show us this dissatisfaction with his past life and how that has led to, as the title of the song is, a change of heart, a desire to move from disappointment into something, and he's not quite sure what, new. Now, I think there's three kinds of disappointment going on in this song. There's a disappointment in people, there's a disappointment in his life, and then there's a disappointment in himself. So we're going to start by looking at the disappointment in other people. So listen to this little segment of the song. Not looking like that you used to have. Alright, so right off the bat, we have this example of him being disappointed in someone. And his reason for being disappointed is really rather shallow. He says, you used to have the face straight out of a magazine. Now you just look like anyone. And so on the one hand, he's being disappointed because it's kind of this sense of disillusionment. But I think that disillusionment is more than just, you know, this girl was once pretty and now she's just normal. It's more of a sense of that the kind of transcendence or interest or specialness that he had accorded this person because of their edginess, because of their rebellion, suddenly has kind of fallen away and it's not as interesting anymore. And he's starting to see her as kind of banal. But this actually comes from the first album. So he's actually referencing this song. All right, so he immediately quotes this exact song, right? He says, in this song, he says, she's got a face straight out of a magazine. And the other one, he says, you used to have a face straight out of a magazine. And this song is important because it's called Robbers, and it's this very dramatic song about this difficult relationship that's hurting everyone's life, but he stays in it because they're just so connected. And now, in this song, he kind of just says this, you used to have a face straight out of the magazine, now you just look like anyone. And it's kind of this realization that the drama and the meaning and that he poured in this kind of rebellion was actually disappointing. She wasn't as big of a deal as he thought. But maybe that's not because of her. Maybe that's just because he was putting all of this hope and expectation into someone that was just a human. And he goes even deeper into that in a line right before this in Change of Heart where he says, you smashed a glass into pieces, that's around the time I left, and you were coming across as clever till you lit the wrong end of your cigarette. And there's this kind of almost a humor in kind of the drama and the edginess of the first album. He's making it look almost silly, almost banal, in the second album. And so you see this real disappointment in the people around him. All the things that appeared cool and edgy are kind of silly, kind of fumbling. And it's causing him, as he says over and over again, to have this change of heart. But it's not just the people that are disappointing. It's also the life that he's been given. The life makes him feel disappointed and sad. And that's really beautifully illustrated and very sadly illustrated in this part. Feel as though I was deceived. Never found love in the city. I'm just sad and self-pity and cried and cried. Oh, I just had a change of heart. So this is the line that I read to you from the very beginning. I feel as though I was deceived. I never found love in the city. Just sat in self-pity and cried in the car. Oh, I've had a change of heart. And to me, this breaks my heart because this is how I feel like a lot of people in my generation feel. But this also connects back again to another song of 1975, which I'll play for you now. All right, so this is the chorus of their song, The City, and it's just saying over and over again, if you want to find love, you know where the city is. And this is kind of their clarion call on the first album. It's all about kind of pushing beyond the boundaries, you know. And so what's so heartbreaking about the Change of Heart song is that he's saying, I tried that. I tried my own clarion call. But he says, actually, no, I don't feel like it was helpful. I feel like I was deceived. It left me in tears. And that really breaks my heart because I think that gets to the core of what I've seen a lot of people my age feel, which is that they were told one way of living would lead to happiness, would lead to close relationships even, when that way actually led them to deep sadness. And they kind of go, well, what do I do with this? What do I do with the disappointment that I have in other people? What do I do with the regrets that I've been given because I lived a way that had to hurt people, even though no one told me any different. And so you see that in this. You see this disappointment that he has with this person that he had built up to be everything. You know, he'd kind of made her in his own image, made her seem like she'd be a wonderful, interesting person. But then at the heart of it, he realizes that she's just a human, somebody who can disappoint, somebody who lights her cigarette on the wrong end and looks silly and takes pictures and puts them on Instagram. And then you see his disappointment with the world that he's been told he should pursue that actually led him to great pain. But I think that the real disappointment here, and actually the disappointment that leads him towards the possibility of redemption, is the disappointment in himself. There's this sense that on the one hand, he feels deceived, right? Like that somebody else led him down the wrong path. And like I said, I think a lot of people have felt that way. I think a lot of people didn't have guidance. I think a lot of people in my generation feel wounded by the ways they've lived, but they also just felt profoundly unguided. But the thing I want to say is that how we live is determined not by what disappoints us, but by how we handle those disappointments. And I think that the hopeful message of this song is the fact that he says over and over again, I've had a change of heart. And to me, that change of heart, the disappointment has actually led him to realize that the life he was living before wasn't satisfying him, that it was actually hurting him, that the things he was pursuing were empty. And the disappointment actually led to the change of heart. By kind of realizing his own complicity in the life he was living, by feeling disappointed with the other people, with the life he'd been given, even with himself, actually gave him the opportunity to have a change of heart, to pursue something more meaningful, to pursue something less banal, less ironic, to hope to find something solid and sturdy. And that's why I think I love and have my heart broken by this song. I feel like a lot of people in my generation have been sold a bill of goods about what their life should be. They've been told, on the one hand, you know, you have people who weren't guided as much, who are just told, do whatever your heart tells you, pursue whatever relationships, you know, do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt people. But the reality is that life is much more complicated than that. And just like Mattie Healy, you eventually find that people can't fulfill your deepest desires. That when you do whatever you want, it's impossible not to hurt people. And you're left with a disappointment with that. And then on the other hand, you have people who were told, if you're good, if you're faithful, if you just try your hardest, if you stay pure, if you do all these things, you'll have happy relationships and you'll succeed and God will bless you. And a lot of people haven't experienced what they thought that blessing would be. But what this song reveals to me is that disappointment can actually be a profound place of turning around and realizing what is really important. I think what Healy's realizing in this song is that all the things he was counting on to be important, to give himself a sense of significance, they really weren't important. And he could just be disappointed the rest of his life and say it was all a sham, or he could take this moment of disappointment and let it be a purifying thing, a thing that burns away all the things that don't matter, a thing that helps him dig in deeper. Disappointment, if you don't let it turn into bitterness, can be the moment of repentance. Now that's a big religious, spiritual word, but what repentance literally means is a turning towards something real, something true. When we repent, we turn towards God. We turn away from what was hurting us and towards God. And to me, Change of Heart is a song about repentance. It's about turning away from all these things that they felt like were empty, were unsatisfying, and not exactly sure what to turn towards, but sure that they needed something more profound, something more real. And I pray for Mattie Healy that he finds the source of that reality that he longs for. And you know what? I'm thankful for the 1975. I'm thankful that they could be honest enough about the disappointments of pursuing things that weren't meaningful to them to help me realize that I want to push past my disappointments and live a life that really matters. The reason I connect to the 1975 is that they're honest. They want a life that means something. And I do too. And I think we can connect over that. Ladies in Lavender is a story about sisters, about memories, about music, about disappointment, and about surprises. The music that you're listening to right now is from the soundtrack of Ladies in Lavender. Part of what makes this movie such a gorgeous film is the stunning soundtrack, which features beautiful violin solos from Joshua Bell. At the heart of it, what this story teaches us is that disappointments, when we hold on to them and let them breed bitterness, breed more disappointments. Whereas, if we let go of disappointments, we open ourselves up to new opportunities, things we couldn't have expected that could be rich, rich gifts. But we cannot accept those gifts unless we first learn to let go of the things that have a hold of our heart. Ladies in Lavender came out in 2004, and two of my very favorite actresses are the main characters. That is Maggie Smith, who plays Janet, and Judi Dench, who plays Ursula. Now, these two are sisters, and the film takes place around 1936, so a few years before World War II. And part of the film is about kind of getting a sense of these two sisters' lives. They live together. This very simple, almost boring life, but in this breathtakingly beautiful place on the edge of the sea. And, you know, last week we talked about World War I and World War II and the ways that that impacted British culture. And one of the ways that we touched on was that especially World War I, because they sent so many of the very best and brightest, but also just all of the young men to war, and the casualties were so heavy in World War I, more heavy than they were in World War II, they basically wiped out an entire generation of young men. They called it the Lost Generation. And the consequence of this was that a lot of young women were left either with their loved ones, their husbands, their fiancés, their boyfriends dying, or just without really anyone to pick from. So you both had a lost generation of men, but you also kind of had a generation of single women. And that I think that was very much felt in the culture of this time. So this story takes place, 20 years, 25 years after that. And it's about these two sisters who are now kind of getting middle to older age. And they have a sweet life, but you sense that one of them in particular was kind of disappointed. You have these kind of flashbacks to her youth, where you realize that she had fallen in love with a young soldier before World War I, but that he died. And so even though she has a good life with her sister, there's kind of this relational disappointment that there was something that she almost had. She almost had a marriage. She almost had this kind of life she could imagine, but she didn't. And the reason I think this pertains to our topic today is that was a real, generational disappointment, I think, that they must have had. Of course, there were great traumas and great issues with World War I besides, but imagine a whole generation of people where there just weren't many men to marry. And it's funny, I've thought about it because even in our day, we haven't lost a whole generation of men, but I think that there's a lot of relational disappointment in my generation. People who wanted to get married but for whatever reason didn't. In America, there are, I believe it's 101 million single adults. So that means that it's nearly 50%. It's like 45% of adults are unmarried, which is the highest it's ever been. And you see a lot of loneliness with that. And I think it's always helpful to know that there were similar moments like this for different reasons. So we may feel kind of disappointed with that and be trying to navigate that as a culture, navigate why are people not getting married? Why are they not connecting? Why are people so lonely? But in this story, you see that a little bit reflected. There's this person who has a good, happy life with her sister, but there's a sense of kind of resignation until this wonderful, mysterious, happy thing happens. And that's that this young man washes up on the beach and the two sisters take care of him, and they begin to nurse him back to health. They make it their mission to take care of this young man. He doesn't speak English, so they try to figure out what he does, and they find out he has this beautiful gift of music. And it becomes this kind of unexpected gift in their life. They're a little bit boring life that really was quite beautiful, but was kind of marked by this disappointment, especially in the one woman's life. And something that happens in the story, kind of an awkwardness or a tension, is that one of the women kind of starts to almost feel too strongly, not really in a romantic way, but just kind of in a, she puts all of the hopes and dreams that she had from that romance in her youth that was taken away from her onto this young man, and he can't bear the pressure of it. It's too much for him. And so the story kind of follows that and looks at the ways in which this happy surprise both brought a great deal of life and of happiness and of love into their life, but also that was in tension with the fact that one of the sisters, rather than accepting this as a brand new thing, kind of wants it to refulfill the romance, the desire, the life that she had when she was young. And I think that what this story tells to me, amongst many other things, it's really just a beautiful, gentle movie. And I said the 1975 probably won't fill up your soul, and listen to them with caution, but Ladies in Lavender will absolutely fill up your soul. And one of the things that I feel like this movie taught to me was the idea that if you have disappointments in life, to be able to live a good life, you have to, at some point, put them to rest. And if you don't let go of them, your hands won't be open to new surprises, to new things, to see the new goodness around you. The more that you hold on to the vision of your life that you thought would be, the less you're able to embrace the good things that come along in your path. And the tension with this character is that she's been brought this great gift, but she nearly ruins it because she wants to make it fit into the expectation of life that she'd had before. And that has been something really formative and interesting for me to think about, is in my life, when I've had disappointments or when my life hasn't looked like I thought it would, it can be really tempting either to hold on to the bitterness of that disappointment or just to hold on to an almost unfounded hope that maybe if I just keep on holding on to the thing that I was disappointed about, that it'll pop up in a different way at some point else in my life. And what I found is that the more that I say yes to the life that has been given me, the more that I allow myself to kind of put to death the dreams that haven't taken place, the more opportunities there are in front of me that surprise me with the graciousness of God, that surprise me with the things that God does provide me. And it sounds, you know, like it's one of the easiest things we should be able to remember, that when we let go of things, God gives us new gifts. But I think that it's actually a very difficult thing to reckon with. And when I look at our world, I think there's a part of us that doesn't want to let go of the disappointment because we are afraid that if we do, there won't be anything to look forward to. There won't be the life, a good life to imagine. You know, if you dreamed your best life and it didn't happen, then how could you give up that dream? Because what if you couldn't actually find it? But what I truly believe is that when we open our hands and let go of the things that we can't control, let go of the disappointments that we can't get back, there will be new things that we can take hold of. There will be new gifts. But we have to receive them as gifts and not try to fit them into the picture that we wanted our life to be. And for me, the way I have phrased this to myself is learning to say yes to life. And by saying yes, I don't mean that you have to like everything in your life, but you just have to say, this is my life. I say yes. These are the confines of my life. This is the puzzle pieces that I have, as my mom always puts it. And you can move forward from that place. But if we always hold on to disappointment, we won't have our eyes open to what new things God could be doing in our lives, to what new things could be before us, to what new opportunities could open up. And I think that this film is such a beautiful, gentle example of that, of someone who had a very genuine disappointment in life, but that as she learned to let go of that, she was able to receive a new and surprising and exciting gift. But if she hadn't let go of it, she wouldn't have been able to truly experience it. Sometimes we can ruin the gifts that God gives us by trying to make them be the thing that we wanted them to be, the thing we expected. But by releasing our expectations, we can experience things that far exceed them. So that is Ladies in Lavender, and I highly recommend that you go watch it. You'll have to drink tea, eat scones if you can, and soak in the loveliness of Maggie Smith, of Judy Dench, of their gentle life, and of their love for the musician and for Joshua Bell's music. You mustn't wish for another life. You mustn't want to be somebody else. What you must do is this: rejoice evermore, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks. Those beautiful words are from the novel Hannah Coulter, published in 2004 by Wendell Berry. Sarah, my sister, and I consider ourselves something of Wendell Berry evangelists, because I think that his voice, almost more than any other, speaks wisely to this world and to this generation. Berry spent years of his life writing stories that all centered around one fictional town of Port Royal, which he based off of his own hometown in Kentucky. Hannah Coulter is one of the books in that series, and it centers and follows the life of one woman named Hannah Coulter, and her life moving from World War II all the way up into the early 2000s. It looks at a life that is full of disappointments, of things she didn't expect, but a life that is rich and that is hopeful. But perhaps before I dive into Hannah's story, it would help me to tell you a little bit about Wendell Berry. Now, I've talked about him before because I just love his work so much. Sarah and I are always trying to get people to read his books. Just today, I ran into kind of an acquaintance in a coffee shop, and he was telling me about he just submitted his PhD and his struggles with how the university sees education as purely practical, and if you can't do that, then you oughtn't get funding. And I went, there's a Wendell Berry essay for that. And so hopefully today I've gained another Wendell Berry enthusiast, and hopefully through today's podcast I'll gain many more. But anyway, Wendell Berry is an essayist, a farmer, a revolutionary. He was born in 1934. He's known for being a novelist, a poet, an environmental activist, a cultural critic, and a farmer. I'm trying to see. He has written an immense amount of work. He has written tons of fiction, which we'll be looking at today with Hannah Coulter, which is one of the Port Royal stories, which is based on his own hometown in Kentucky. But he's also written many essays, some of my favorite by him. There's two books I absolutely love that I think really should be required reading for our world when you think about the issues that we faced and the issues that we face together and how we need to move forward. One of them is Life is a Miracle, an Essays Against Modern Superstition. And that has a lot to do with education, with how we talk about tradition, passing on the most important values of the heritage that we all have. And so that's wonderful. And then another book of his that I absolutely love is a book called Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community. And one of the things that Barry really focuses on in that book, but also in his career in general, is that over his lifetime, you know, he's born in the 30s, he says that he has seen what he calls kind of the degradation of communities, which is, he said, there used to be this kind of what Charles Taylor would call bundles of communities, where there was the farmer and you knew your next door neighbor, and you all went to the same church and you bought locally. And this was good in numerous ways. One of the ways was, firstly, that it was a profitable, sustainable society where farming worked, where people all had a trade that they were good at. But it was also good in the sense that the community was the place where people were formed. There was a sense that you're responsible to everyone around you. It's a place that kind of naturally cultivates virtue. But what he says happened is that as industrialism took over and as farms began to take over, I'm talking out of my depth here. I'm sure that if you were a real farmer, you could correct me. But as industrial farms took over, as kind of farm as machine or farm as factory took over, you began to see it took out a lot of little farmers, people who used to have a craft, whether that was actually farming or carving wood or doing all these things, began to not have a profession, didn't have a way to make money. And so they started going out into the cities. And then the people who were left in the towns and the farms were kind of left to poverty. There weren't jobs, there weren't schools, there weren't people to be around. And this really grieves Barry. And he said, you know, when we do this, we're not only destroying the communities, we're also giving over the care of the land to people who don't care about the land. You know, farmers can spend generations and generations figuring out how land works and figuring out how to work with it, figuring out how to do the things that are the most sustainable, the best for the earth, the best for the crop. He said, but when we give it over, when we begin to treat it like a machine, the earth begins to die and so does the community around it. And so Barry saw this in Kentucky, and I love Kentucky. It's where my Aunt Gwenny lives, who I love dearly, and I'm going to visit soon. But there's been a lot of issues in Kentucky because of this. There's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of bad schools, and what Barry says is that that really boils down to this disintegration of communities, that that both hurt the communities, hurt the schools, hurt the economies, and then also hurt the earth. So Barry has spent his whole life telling people that one of the most worthwhile things you can do is to invest in a small life, in a sustainable life, in a life of faith, and a life of community. And this has become, I think, more and more clear as we've gotten into these past few years, that life as we are living it right now is not sustainable. It's not sustainable for the earth, certainly. We need to be more careful with the way that we're farming, the way that we take care of our environments. But it's also just, you're seeing a great rise in mental health issues, in a sense of isolation and loneliness. You know, Barry's call, I think, which many have perceived as kind of this idealistic agrarian imaginary lifestyle, is actually a call to reality. So I'm sorry, I'm getting off on my loving Wendell Berry. So let me tell you about the story of Hannah Coulter. Because basically, Wendell Berry has spent his entire life fighting for this in a culture that has just really not cared a lot. And what you see in Hannah Coulter is a life that lives through that community disintegration. And because of that, it's a life where there are many disappointments. It begins with her life as a little girl. I think she grows up in the 20s, and she lives through the Depression, but there's a sense of satisfaction in the life that she has with her grandmother and the work that she does that's meaningful. And then she falls in love with a young man, and they get married and have a baby, and he goes to war and dies. And then When, you know, after that, she's this kind of young woman, she's a widow, and her life is disappointing then. But then there's all these disappointments that keep coming up, because eventually she ends up marrying this wonderful man named Nathan. And Nathan has come home from the war. He never likes to speak of the war, but he comes home with this conviction that kind of what God has called him to is to make a beautiful life of the place that he's been given. And this goes against a lot of the inclinations that Barry says a lot of people were experiencing in the 50s. And what they experience now, he said, what people feel like is when they're disappointed with life, they feel like the answer is just to go somewhere better, to find something better. And that impulse is what began to create this kind of disintegration where people didn't know each other, or people were isolated, where people were working all their lives in an office and not having the satisfaction of community and family. And so Nathan Coulter in this book stands as kind of the opposite of that. I want to read you this quote from the book. It says, most people now are looking for a better place, which means that a lot of them will end up in a worse one. I think this is what Nathan learned from his time in the army and the war. He saw a lot of places, and he came home. I think he gave up the idea that there is a better place somewhere else. There is no better place than this, not in the world. And it is by the place we've got, and our love for it, and our keeping of it, that this world is joined to heaven. Something better. Everyone's talking about something better. The important thing is to feel good, to be proud of what you've got, no matter if it ain't nothing but a log pin. Those thoughts came to me in the night. Those thoughts and thoughts of becoming sick or helpless, of the nursing home, of lingering death. I gnaw again the old bones of fear of what is to come, and grieve over those who have gone before. Finally, as a gift of mercy, I remember to pray, thy will be done. And then again, I am free and can go to sleep. So this is Hannah thinking about her dear husband, Nathan. And most of the story follows their marriage. He's the second one that she marries after she's widowed. And you see this life that they live together. They create a good life. They have children together. They farm. They take care of their community. And one by one, there's even disappointments in their old age. Their children, one by one, move away. There's this sense of kind of, will it be worth it? Will what we've done be worth it? But at the end, I don't want to give it away to you, but at the end, there's this moment of hope and of kind of the possibility that because they were there, because they kept this home, because they kept the faith, because they were faithful to a place, because they didn't run away, they were able to be the source of hope in a disappointing world for one of their grandchildren. And to me, this is a picture. You know, in the last one, we were talking about how we have to let go of disappointments, or else we'll never be able to receive new gifts. But what do we do when we're in a world that just feels disappointing, and we're not sure that we will receive new gifts? And I think that Hannah Coulter and Wendell Berry's kind of way of seeing the world is really the answer to that. I was reading recently in a book called Poetic Theology by William Dyerness, where he talked about that the essential thing in life is not what you make, money or home, whatever. It's what you make of the life that you are given. And I think that that is the ultimate way to move past disappointment. And it's ultimately the way that my generation will be defined by what we do with it, rather than just with our experience of disappointment. What you see in Hannah Coulter is a life that wasn't easy, that was disappointing, that had great sorrows. But because Nathan, this almost kind of Christ figure, chooses to be faithful to the life that he's been given, to not want to be someone else, brings great hope to other people. He decides not to reject the life that's been given to him. It's kind of like when Jesus says, take this cup from me, but not my will, but yours be done. Nathan sees, and Hannah with him, sees this cup, their life, their community, as the cup that he's called to drink. And as he drinks it, he is able to bring hope and grace and love to his family and his future generations. And this is not simply a call to kind of a passive, just be thankful, just accept, just be content. Because I think that if it were that, then we would just all stay how we are, disappointed. And I don't think that's enough. I think that there are kind of radical changes that we need to make in the world if we're going to live satisfying, meaning-filled, Christ-centered lives. But one of those things that I think we need to understand is that those things aren't some distant, kind of glamorous life. It means taking all of the pieces that we have, whether they're disappointing or problematic or whatever, and making something of them. And the thing that I think is also important in Hannah Coulter is that it's not just trying really hard at the pieces you have. It's learning that the thing that makes life meaningful is the love that we pour into the places and people that we live. Nathan Coulter and Hannah Coulter with him build this legacy that brings hope even in the disappointments of their life because they fill the corners of their home with the love that they have. I love this quote, also from the book. It says, "The living can't quit living because the world's turned terrible and people they love are need are killed. They can't because they don't. The light that shines in the darkness and never goes out calls them on into life. It calls them back again into the great room. It calls them into their bodies and into the world, into whatever the world will require. It calls them into work and pleasure, goodness and beauty, into the company of other loved ones." So what I would say to myself, to us, and to my generation is, of course we're disappointed in the world. We have found a lot of the things that our modern society has been built on are broken. They're unsustainable. And there's a lot of things to be sad about, to be lonely about, to be disappointed about. But what I want to say to us is that we have to think of our lives like Nathan Coulter, like Hannah Coulter. Not that we ignore the sorrow, but that we say, what will I make of this life? How will I invest my love? How will I let the light that shines in the darkness, that cannot be overcome, call me back again and again to work and pleasure, goodness and beauty, and to the company of my loved ones? That's how we overcome disappointment. Not by holding on to bitterness, but also not by slipping into passivity. We overcome disappointment by making something of the pieces that have been given to us. By opening our hands and saying, God, what can I do with this little life? And recognizing that in our world that's depersonalized, that's unsustainable, that is full of constant connection with the internet and little close relationships and friendships, one of the most important things you could possibly be doing is living a life that is small, that is faithful, that is personal, and that is sustainable. So as we draw to a close, let's remember what we've discussed today. First, we talked about how disappointment can actually be a moment of repentance, an ability to realize what things in our life aren't worthwhile and to turn away from them towards something deeper and something real. And our guide in that was an unexpected one, the 1975, a band that is honest about their dissatisfaction with the world, and people who I hope very much eventually find a firm foundation. The second thing we talked about is how if we don't release our disappointments and release our bitterness, sometimes we aren't able to receive the gifts that life has given us, that God has given us. We talked about that in the context of Ladies in Lavender and the beautiful story about a musician, about memories, and about sisters. And finally, we talked about how the way to overcome disappointment is to make something beautiful of our life in the small and faithful moments. I want to end today by playing a song for you that meant a lot to me in a period of my own disappointment. The chorus reads, "There's no making cases for getting out or changing places. You are here." And when I heard that, it was at a period of my life where I needed to know that this was my one life, my one short life. And as much as the disappointments had brought me down, I knew that I needed to get up to make something beautiful of this life that I've been given, even with all of its disappointments and issues. So I hope that that encourages you all. I'm praying for you all this week. I truly am. And I know that you will continue to live lives that press in to goodness, to beauty, to truth. And I look very forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. This is You Are Here by the Wailing Jennies. You wonder why, you wonder when, you wonder how now and then, how you became. A dream of being there, of being where you think the good life has begun. In every darkened hallway, every fallen dream, every battle.
to your knees and closer to the reason. And there's no making cases, getting up, trading places. And there's no turning back while you are here. No, you are to your knees and closer to the reason.